This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we start the last session of the day. I just want to quickly let you know what the procedure is going to be, and then Orla is going to take over from me. What this whole session is about is for your chance and the chance of these people here to say something about the exhibition in one way or another. We also have another inclusion, Kira O'Toole, who's with us, who is an artist and who works in Gosford. Yes, has an object of art, shall I call it that, an art object in the exhibition, which we actually commissioned, I think, for the exhibition. So I want to give Kira the chance just for a little four-minute spiel about what it was she was trying to do with that bit of the thing. But apart from that, I'm going to hand over to Orla, and then at the very end, I will also do a bit of summing up of what's been thrown at me. As a matter of fact, I might go home, I think. Orla.
Is this,
you've got that. This,
can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Thank you very much, Richard. Well, I'm Orla Tunney from the Irish Embassy, and the Embassy is privileged to have been a partner in the Not Just Ned exhibition, and as such, I've been involved with the preparations for it pretty much since I arrived in Australia 3 years ago, and it's been a true delight to be involved with it, and I hope you think so as well. I'm really interested to hear your views. So as Richard said, what I'm going to do is ask our three panellists to speak for about 5 minutes each, then we'll hear from Kira, and then I want to have a good lively discussion, so get your questions ready, and then Richard will come in at the end. So I hope that we'll have time for about a half an hour of discussion in the middle. So the first speaker that I'm going to call on is Pat Cook, who's come all the way from Ireland, and indeed the Irish government are delighted to have supported Pat's attendance at this conference and are delighted that he's here. And Pat, as a curator, will have his own views on the exhibition and his own perspective. And without further ado, I'm going to start the clock on you, Pat. Go ahead.
Okay, Orla has asked me to be quite brief, which I will be. I'm going to just confine it to 2 points. The first one is I want to look at it with as somebody who's actually gone through a similar experience as Richard has, which is to do an exhibition on a highly ideological subject in a highly contested space, and what that is like to do, and how you might construct, how you're going to manage that sort of thing. And the way it came out for me doing a major exhibition on Irish nationalism in Kilmainham Jail at the time before even the Good Friday Agreement had been concluded, while the violence was still going on, was we created a collaborative system of investigating what the questions were. And the ultimate point we arrived at was we know that we're never going to have an adequate explanation. People are always going to find things that are missing. That is the inherent nature of these things. And people are going to contest what you've said and what you've done. That's just simply a given. But the only thing that really mattered was, if somebody says to you, why is that there? You have an answer as to why it is there. You have a rationale. You have, it's kind of a, basically, you've got its job description for why that object is sitting in that exhibition. And having walked around the space with Richard the other day, I am absolutely satisfied that Richard has fulfilled that in spades. The level and depth of his research has been such, his level of agonization over the issues has been such that I think he knows what the job description of every single item in that exhibition is. And I empathize with that, and I kind of admire that. That clearly you wouldn't expect intellectual laziness from Richard Reed anyway, would you? The second point is a more philosophical one, and it arises from a thought I keep always to the fore of my mind when it comes to the deployment of exhibitions. It's a Chinese phrase. If you want to gain knowledge, add something every day. If you want to gain wisdom, take something away. And one of the most difficult things I find about exhibitions is how much. How much gets the story across, and what are the implications of too much, potentially, too little, potentially. And I suppose there was a question in my mind, was there too much in the exhibition, actually? I put the question to Richard at dinner the other night. If you'd done the director of the British Museum? See, that's the jet lag. Sorry? 100 objects. You know, the history of the world in 100 objects. It was a hugely inspirational, haiku-like approach to a major, when you can't get bigger subject than that, can you? The history of the world. And I'm just wondering, could you take things out of that exhibition and actually make it stronger in certain ways? And the other thing then, that just this is the final point, is that I'm always fascinated by the way that exhibitions escape all of the best intentions of the rationalizing process of narrative and all of the rest of it. Because objects have this unique quality. They create dream worlds. The object escapes into an imaginative zone, an aesthetic space that is simply uncontainable. And it's a funny thing, you know. I was reminded by that exhibition of something that I had forgotten, which is that in my 20s, I had read virtually everything by Patrick White. I was a huge fan of Patrick White. And suddenly these images, these landscapes from Voss, and then triggered straight away Sidney Nolan, just came back, and it was the elk antlers that did it. It was that absolutely surreal, absurdist quality of any exhibition for the object just simply to declare itself in its own ineffable, transcendent presence that you are just thrown back on a set of mental images and associations. So something I had completely forgotten, that I had read Patrick White, and that suddenly it was brought back to me and it all made sense in that kind of way.
Thank you very much, Pat. Didn't sound too jet-lagged to me, I must say. Thanks, some very provocative thoughts in there. And I know you're all taking notes in the room to come back on some of those questions. Because, you see, if I had to reduce that exhibition to 100 objects, I would have taken the elk antlers out and then you wouldn't have had that moment. So the question is which 100 you want to keep in. Next I'm going to call on our eminent historian from Victoria, Val Noon, here to my right. And Val, I'm starting the clock on your 5 minutes. I'll be very strict.
I couldn't hear, Pat, what it was you read in your youth.
Sorry, Patrick White. I've read virtually all of Patrick White's novels.
Oh, Patrick like
Vivisector,
White.
Voss, Patrick White, yes. A great Australian novelist. I didn't even think when I was coming here that I had read this great Australian novelist, you know. It just wasn't there, and it was the exhibition that triggered it.
To get it in 5 minutes, I've written out every word, a paragraph, a page. The Not Just Ned exhibition marks a turning point in the history of Irish Australia. In general, it is, as it claims, about everyone who came from Ireland. So I'm here to congratulate the National Museum of Australia, to congratulate Richard Reid and the staff. Speaking on behalf of many people who are here, I have a request to the National Museum. Can we please have a complete photographic or DVD record of every object and every caption? Now to the question, what sort of history is it? I have 5 dot points. On the cover of the catalogue is the image of a ritual object of late 19th century and early 20th century Catholicism, a monstrance. Indeed, an Italianate, or as my mates would say, Italianate, monstrance. To me, that is not a symbol of Irish Australia. Point two, this display is biased in favour of the rich and powerful, the higher ranks. To illustrate my point, there is a panel on lawyers, barristers and judges, which is great. But we also need a panel on seamstresses, farm labourers, railway gangers, wharfies and domestic servants. The overwhelming majority of the Irish who came to Australia came as labourers and domestic servants. Does the exhibition therefore give implicit support to the capitalist myth that if you work hard, you are bound to succeed? Point three, the exhibition displays a naive faith in the pioneer legend. The Durex and Winter Pratts represent wealthy squatters, but battling small farmers could have done with more attention. Ned Ryan and Patsy Durack are portrayed as heroic individuals clearing uninhabited land and making a fortune. In 1947, Frank Clune said Ned Ryan had a lot of trouble with the blacks. Max Barrett, in his 2000 revised edition of Kings of the Book on Geelong, has an appendix on Ned Ryan and the Aborigines. Kings in Grass Castles, the 1988 miniseries by John Wood, much acclaimed, fictionalised the Durack story, but it accurately portrayed a massacre in which they were involved, and it showed that the grass castles were blown away within a generation. So the pioneer myth, I believe, it lives on in the exhibition. Point four, the issue of language. As some of you may know, Richard recently wrote a book called Sinners, Saints and Settlers, which sells with the exhibition. In the introduction, he argued, we have to turn away from the hallowed heartlands of the last Irish-speaking reserves in Ireland. The NMA has done that. Yet, yes, there is more to Irish Australia than the hallowed heartlands, but all who wish to understand Irish heritage need to learn about the heartlands and need to know about the Gaelic culture from which they came. Most who came to Australia in the 19th century came from a land of two languages, and that is not at all clear in the exhibition. Dot point five. In world history, the human race is at a point where the recent centuries of European industrialisation, expansion and imperialism, an economic system based on burning carbon, have now come to a crisis. I looked in vain in the exhibition for any sign that any of the migrants had a second thought about clearing the forests and polluting the air. Not Just Ned is wonderful, marvellous, and sensational, but it leaves unanswered this question. Is this the last gasp of Irish Australia, or will it contribute to a reinvigorated adaptation of Irish ways to Australian realities?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Val. Some thought-provoking points there, as always. I, for one, am very glad that there was nothing about carbon capture and storage in the exhibition, because I seem to be bombarded with messages about it from the moment I wake to when I go to sleep every day. So it was nice to go back to a simpler time when we didn't have to worry about our carbon footprint. But certainly it's a valid point that those settlers surely were embarking on a project for which the end result was far from clear at the time. Now, the next speaker that I'm going to call on is Shane Carmody, and I know you've all just come out of Shane's plenary session, so I'm going to put to him the challenge now of finding some new points and to just throw out another 5 minutes of provocation to you to prepare you for the discussion to come. So I'll hand over to you now, Shane.
My earliest conversations with Richard about this exhibition were over a coffee in our coffee shop at the library, and I think I rather aggressively said to him, "You're not just going to do another Redmond Barry versus Ned Kelly moment in the exhibition, are you?" And he has answered that question emphatically in that respect. But I find it very interesting that we start the exhibition with a reference to Ned. The title is obviously meant as a challenge, and I don't know whether McIntyre's description of the Kelly outbreak as a true history is the first use of that phrase. I don't know whether we've found it anywhere else in a specific Irish reference, but obviously gets picked up by Peter Carey and now in this exhibition. And I think that's quite interesting, because I think that the notion of truth in history is one of those very slippery subjects. I personally find the exhibition overwhelming and fantastic, but then I think it's a truly Victorian exhibition. I don't mean the state from which I come, but the century described as Victorian, insofar as it is like one of those great exhibitions where everything's in it. And in a sense, museum practice has moved away from that significantly, and I just found the richness of it fabulous. I am really delighted to see so many people in there obviously enjoying that detail. I'm hearing Val's points, and I suspect there's some truth in those criticisms. And I hadn't really thought about that as I walked through the exhibition myself. The other thing that I think I would say about it is that it's a very affirming project for this institution. This is a very young museum. It can't hope to collect a collection of the complexity that it's now displaying in that exhibition hall, but it can, with decent support, mount exhibitions of that scale. And I, for one, would support that endeavour wholeheartedly. It didn't take very long for the library to decide that Ned Kelly could, the armour could come here to visit. In fact, we were prepared, although in the end common sense prevailed, to lend the vast and huge and very impressive portrait of O'Shaughnessy as well, but it was just too fragile and too difficult to get off the wall. But the opportunity for us to contribute and to participate was marvellous, and I would do it again in a blink. And I would just like to thank and commend my colleagues in this institution who have been part of this. They've been an absolute pleasure to deal with, all of them. And that's a fantastic affirmation of what the purpose of a national museum might be. So I would I look forward to the next opportunity, whatever true history it might be.
Thank you very much, Shane. And I'd like to add to what you say that we too were thrilled that the museum, in embarking on this examination of one migrant group that contributed to the building of Australian society, that we were delighted that the Irish were first. And I suppose also delighted that they were embarking on that train. And I imagine that other migrant groups will now be clamouring to have their own exhibitions. But I think it's a valid examination to take place on the different streams and the different threads that were woven into the fabric of Australia. And we were thrilled that the Irish were first, and indeed thrilled that the National Museum of Australia was the first national museum in any of the major diaspora countries around the world to put together an exhibition of this type about the Irish. You know, people think about the USA and other countries in the world that accepted a lot of Irish migration, but none of them have had their national museum attempt a an exhibition like this. So that was another reason that we paid tribute to them, especially doing it at a time when their budgets were crunched and everything else. It was tremendous how much went into it. Okay, now before opening the floor for discussion, I'm going to call on Ciara O'Toole, who is the artist who has a work in the exhibition, rather more modern than lots of the other pieces in there. And Ciara is going to speak for a few minutes about the thoughts that went into her work. And then after that, we'll send the microphone up around the room to hear your thoughts.
Hello. Well, I've been put under the thumb because Richard just asked me like 20 minutes ago, so forgive me. And I'm pregnant, so I've got baby brain. So there's a few things you need to forgive me for. So I actually had a part of my... I'll just read you quite quickly an abstract from my thesis to give you a context of the work downstairs. And I don't know if you know the work. It's the handmade Kurax with the seaweed roots, and I haven't seen them. It will make much more sense when you then see them. Can you see me?
Either you can stand up and talk to that.
Okay.
Stand up.
Sorry.
Just what are you doing talking away from
it? Sorry. Hello? Can you hear me now? Yes.
Okay. Turn the lapel mic off.
There you go. You say. Hello? Now, can you hear me? Am I clear? You can hear me. I'm speaking. You can hear. Great. Okay, so I'll just read a quick abstract. So I won't be long. So Irish art critic Fintan O'Toole observes that the Irish diaspora travels through the labyrinths of the wide world, and they are bringing with them a ball of thread, Irish thread, to which to find the way back home. The imagined umbilical cord which ties me to old Ireland has activated underlying questions of Irishness. Contemplation of Irish national identity discloses three key themes: nationalism, the Roman Catholic Church, and the West of Ireland. As an expatriate, the disjunctive experience of living outside my own physical and cultural living space has informed my fascination with Irishness. The realisation that to understand oneself as Irish in Australia, it is necessary to reflect on my place of origin and probe what it means to be an Irish artist in Australia. My studio practice is deliberated and worked out through mark making as drawing and sculpture of work as art. Trial and error processes and practice determine and reflect the substantial questions of what is Irish national identity in relation to place. The West of Ireland is where this setting is played out, and it's juxtaposed with my experience of being a migrant Australian. So I'll just explain the actual work itself. So that was kind of like a really broad context. The curragh is employed as a signifier for location and identity. The artwork in the Muroch, which is immigrant, serves as a site for a personal sense of loneliness attached to migration and is as a measurement of the presence of self and work that is troubled by absence and lost and is denoted by the seaweed roots. Formed from subjective memory, the inaccurate and flawed measurements and materials of the curragh reflect my physical dislocation and strained relationship to the west of Ireland. However, repetition of the curragh motif underpins my position of the continued authority, however remote, of the imagery of the west as representation, whether real or imagined, as true Irishness for the whole of the Republic of Ireland. The curragh has been in use for more than 2,000 years and a continuum of a physical and a cultural symbol linked to a particular place. The work seeks self-realisation and national identification in an exotic terrain, while recalling a familiar yet generic community in a generic landscape. My artistic syntax explores natural materials as metaphor for cultural and national identity. The physical and cultural landscapes of the familiar landscape, Irish landscape, are removed. Sorry. As a substitute, the Irish native bushnuts are embedded within individual curraghs that articulates the exotic, unfamiliar terrain. The last paragraph, so it won't be long. The bushnuts become deterrained through the amalgamative process of collecting of natural materials from expansive and diverse landscape. In turn, the unique origin of the bushnuts is translated into a generic account of Australian typography. Engagement with the natural materials from the landscape suggests a familiarity with local landscape. In actuality, the natural materials were bought and paid for. To further rupture initial familiar readings of the bushnuts or gumnuts, such as May Gibbs' gumnut babies, layers of black acrylic paint coat the native material. The juxtaposition of the Australian landscape with the Irish activates notions of inherited colonial perspectives. The bushnuts serve as a poetic approach in the production of an aesthetic experience, indicating the primordial ground on which the exhibition is played out. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, Ciara. And if you haven't seen her artwork already, it's one of the very many objects in the exhibition which merits just taking a little time to have a look at and contemplate. I've been fortunate enough to be able to visit the exhibition many times, and I kind of feel sorry for any of you who've travelled from long distances and only have time to have one big bite at it, because I've certainly enjoyed nibbling away at it over the last few months. Okay, well, now, it's now 4:30, and we're aiming to finish at 10 to, being sure that we'll be finished at 5 to. So that leaves us with at least 20 minutes for discussion. So is there somebody who is burning to ask a question? The microphone is there, ready for you. Surely not. Okay, we've one here and one here, so you're first.
Yeah, but I got the microphone quicker.
Oh, I don't
dance it.
That's harder.
Can I just ask the question of anybody on the panel? To what extent do you believe that the exhibition is attractive to and entertaining to the young people, particularly the schools, and taking into account that schools these days, whether they be Catholic or otherwise, are very multicultural?
Interesting question. Who wants to go first on that one?
Well, I'm quite sure that Ned Kelly has the same appeal in Canberra as he has in Melbourne. And the photograph I showed of all those kids entranced around the story is. I mean, one of the things that I had to explain, the word slipped out, really. I got an email from our education officer. I hear a rumour that you're letting Ned go to Canberra for 4 months. How can you do this to us? And I said, find something else to talk about. So I'm sure there are aspects of the story that really grab the kids. And I noticed that some of the labels have been written in a way to engage them. But I saw young people in there today and they seem to be very interested. So I think I'm sure that's been the experience.
One of the great things about the object rich end of the spectrum is that it creates a kind of cornucopia of objects, which is kind of like what kids like anyway. They respond to clutter in a kind of a positive way, and it allows them to kind of settle and make choices, which are their choices. often the problem with an awful lot of modern museum design is it's way over-schematized. There is no serendipity. There's nothing there for you to casually find. It's all been placed right there for your schematic discovery, if that's not a contradiction in terms. So that, I think, is a real strength of the exhibition. You really do have to look and see. And it's highly visual. That's the other great thing about it. And kids are just highly visual. I don't think, just and the final point would be, I don't think we can actually fully speak to this subject because we don't know, we can't see what sort of educational programming effort the education department of the museum has put into this. And you see, that is actually invisible. So that's the other bit of the iceberg that we can't really comment on.
You. I know my kids certainly enjoyed it anyway, and I've seen plenty of children in there, particularly trying to learn to play the spoons. I think children are visual, but they're auditory as well. Yeah. And one of the things that I like about that exhibition when you go in is that there's a buzz. You come in from the main hall, which is quite cavernous and echoing, and you go in, and between the audio that's playing and the discussions that are going on and the music and the people trying out the bower on, there's a buzz in there. And my kids anyway always end up in the crack playing the spoons again. Val, did you want to?
No.
Okay, good question. Thank you. Now, this gentleman
right,
here
okay.
is next.
Actually, it's mainly in response to Val's criticism. So there's something that I like. There's one word I would describe this exhibition from my perspective. It's a connoisseur's exhibition. There's so much richness in this. I really would have to say that. It's a sense of that, and it's a word that's not being used. And I know that sounds elitist, but I think it is wonderful in the sense, and I pay tribute to the connoisseurs who have, I mean, the chief connoisseur, I know, but the things that have flowed into this. Now, the criticisms, the points of critique, etc., one can say that this is not mentioned, that does not mention. There is, in fact, at least one name in that exhibition, though Modest is out, is quite striking in the arguments over climate and an Irish background, which fine, and that's not mentioned for obvious reasons because his role was in another area. But I think that point is the fact that you can't mention everything. There's a limitation to how much information you can take in, and I think it's reached the level, there's a limitation to how much of the richness. So it is a connoisseur's feast, but we have to accept the limitations of how much the public can accept and wash in. So I think there needs to be a balance there, and that's what I have to say. But I think this aspect, it does have a rich cultural flavour, which I've not seen in many exhibitions, really.
Thank you. Does anybody want to respond to that? No, I think we'll agree with that. Lady in the mustard top there. Siobhan.
Yeah, thanks, Orla. Yeah, I kind of, now that Val's pointed that out, I sort of do feel that there should be more of the ordinary people, the seamstresses and the wharfies and the servants and that kind of thing. I think that could have been a very fruitful area. But I just want to put the question back to Val. If the monstrance is not the symbol of Irish Australia, and again, I think that's a good point because it does identify us very much as Catholic Australia, you know, and as we know, there were 20% of Irish who weren't Catholic. What is the symbol of Irish Australia? What do you want to see on the front page, cover of the book?
Well, I'll take the job for the next 3 years for the next exhibition, and then by the time we get to the exhibition's opening, I'll give you the answer.
Oh, I don't know. Are we going to 2 years? Are we going to let him away with that?
I was intrigued. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, Kira. I'm from the west of Ireland. My husband's from Galway. I walked through the exhibition and I got nothing but a sense of hope on what this country has to offer people. And I don't mean that in a triumphalist way. I don't mean it in any way. But, you know, the sense of loss. A lot of us migrants came out here and said, whoopee. I apologise. You know, but I mean, because it takes me back to that Irish sense of, oh, here we go, victims and loss and...
No.
All right, okay, because I do think, for me, I walked out of the exhibition, I said, oh, that was good, and yeah, that's over the top. But I came out with a wonderful sense of hope that what Australia has actually offered to the Irish. So I'd like to thank you, Richard, for that.
Thank you. Now, there was a hand up there, which is gone now. Okay, so we have one over here and one up there. Here first.
I think that it's an amazing exhibition. Sorry. And, you know, as an Australian of total Irish background on all sides, I think it's a very powerful testament that there's been something like this, which, as Richard told me a long time ago, will never happen again, and it's the first and whatever. And I think as Australia's largest minority group, it's very important that it was this group that was represented. So I have only one minor point, and it's because I'm a writer, and it's because editing my work is really important to be done by other people, because I don't see it necessarily myself. And I think you ought to have had a Catholic check the wording of or everything to do with religion. And the only one I can pick out, because I haven't had enough time in it, in the text about the boy making his first communion, Catholics don't take communion, they receive it. Okay? So it's minor, but, you know, when you're into editing and language...
Where I came from, we made our communion.
That's a bit of fun.
No.
So give it
Thanks.
Back.
Turn on. Can I take up Val's third point of contention? That's the one about the exhibition showing a naive confidence in the pioneer legend. And I think this really is, that's a score as far as I'm concerned. And in Ireland, there's already a really ferocious debate about the issue of Irish violence. I've heard Anne Dolan from TCD talking, for example, in an absolutely riveting talk about the assassination of British troops prior to the Crip Park massacre, and owning the violence as well as the reaction. And we know that this museum was born in a massive debate about the black armband. Now, if you say that the Irish make up, you know, the numbers vary, say 25% of the settler population. Well, we know what settler colonialism is. According to writers like Nicholas Thomas, you know, settler colonialism is genocidal. What was the involvement of the Irish in the occupation which led to the genocide of many peoples in this continent? And that's not present in the text of the exhibition.
Richard, I wasn't going to call you in until the end because we're...
No.
Yeah, just saying, really, it's Val's point.
Yeah, but this one about the Aboriginal thing is so central to this disease, is actually
We have stated deliberately on the settler panel that the Irish occupied the land at the expense of the Aboriginal people. That is stated in the text. We do also have shields that were picked up through a violent frontier conflict event in 1836 in Victoria and taken back to Ireland to be displayed there or to be given to a museum there. And that event is discussed, and also the actual attitude of the settler himself, who talks about these lower kinds of life on the land, right? So we have brought that in. Now, the question is, should we have made that, you know, right throughout in all instances? That was difficult. You know, it was one of those things, like in New South Wales, I can remember in the 1980s, they came in with a mandatory policy in schools. Like in every lesson, you must mention Aboriginality, you must mention this, you must mention that. And of course, teachers just threw up their hands in horror and saying, you know, you can't determine it like that. You know, when it comes in, you can do it. And we have definitely set it in there to let people know that we understand fully that the occupation of this country was at the expense of the Aboriginal people. And the Irish were part of that. So, you know, I just think you've got to be aware of that. It is there. You mightn't have seen it, but we have done it. We've also brought in each situation with the Sisters of John of God and the Stolen Generation up in the Northwest. And we've stated it. You know? So I don't think that we've shied away from that. You know? At all.
Thank you, Richard. And the Daisy Bates feature was interesting as well in that regard, and I think in approaching that it was, in fairness, quite clear that although Daisy was considered a visionary at the time, in retrospect, perhaps not so much. But these people were of their era, of course, and it's difficult to apply what we know now to what was going on then. Now, so... you're next.
On Val's point about the monstrance not being a symbol of Irish Catholicism, Patrick O'Farrell said something which made me understand, which I had never understood. I'd been going to Catholic churches in Australia for 50 years without realising they were Australian Baroque, coming from Irish Baroque, coming from Spanish Habsburg Baroque, which came originally from Italian and Austrian Baroque. So if you're St Francis Church in Melbourne, the suburban churches were junkyards full of everything which had gold, plated and everything, having ciboria, having incense, having monstrances. The design and the experience of Australian Catholicism was, in a sense, Baroque, which the monstrance... Now, the word Irish Baroque, I think, is a joke term, but that's a very good description of the physical sensibility of Australian Catholicism, which O'Farrell pointed out. So I think the monstrance does... I mean, the experience of being in Newman College and singing Gregorian is a non... Baroque experience. There are other forms of expressing Catholicism. The Australian Irish one, I think, is a Baroque one, which the monstrance symbolises.
Okay, Siobhan?
Yeah, sorry, just to come back on that point about the Irish Aboriginal relationship, and at the risk of, you know, getting into serious trouble, it's a very complex area, and I know you could also argue that there is a disproportionate solidarity among Irish people and Aboriginal people, which is the flip side of that dispossession approach. And, you know, I just know this from oral histories, which is obviously an area that I'm coming from, that there's a disproportionate number of Irish names among Aboriginal activists, people like Pat O'Shane, Gary Foley. We know them all. We know that Pat Dodson came from Irish Aboriginal background, a Protestant small farmer from Monaghan. So that, you know, it doesn't have to be this big, you know, scourging ourselves. It's not an extreme position that the Irish were at one point the dispossessors only, or at the other point honorary blackfellas, which is the way that it's been presented to me in some cases. On Palm Island, for instance, when I went there to make a documentary in the 90s, that's how some of Bill Congo, who led the strike there in 1957, saw the Irish as fellow travellers in the fight for justice. And those oral histories exist. And I think there is a specific affinity between Irish and Aborigines on the grounds of being mutually oppressed by the same oppressor in the past, and on the grounds of having an oral tradition and a love of land, which could be explored. So if we're going to look at that aspect, I think it's far more complex than just whipping ourselves for being the dispossessors.
Perhaps a whole other exhibition just devoted to that subject.
We've had some pretty limp-wristed criticisms of the exhibition this afternoon. We're now visiting something that turns up in every Australian historical debate. Taking Pat's point, inevitably, this is always going to be a contested space. If we weren't having this discussion, if the thing had been done some other way, that, for instance, addressed the points that Val made, we would be having some other discussion. My question to the panel is this. Is the exhibition too safe? Does that contested space, in fact, need to have been beefed up a bit?
Can I take that? Because this is literally the thought that's going through my head at this present moment. National museums have a really difficult job. They have to be stereotypical liberals. They have to wear their heart on their sleeve. They have to be encyclopedic. They have to cover all the bases. And they have to please everybody. The task is clearly very doable and almost completely impossible. Which is why I would never pick ever a national museum that I know anywhere as my favourite museum. I always like museums that have a cause, have almost a prejudice. I remember once in Kilmainham, one of the guides took a call at the desk one day, and it was a Northern Ireland voice.
And they were from East Belfast, you know, and they wanted a tour of Kilmaine. And I said, we're the UDF branch here in Belfast. And they said, what kind of a tour would you like? They said, we want the hate tour. Just give us pure republicanism. In other words, they didn't want any of your fancy postmodernist problematization liberalism. Just give us republicanism straight up. And of course, some of my favourite places in Northern Ireland are the places that wear unionism on their sleeve. I love that Red Hand in Mount Stuart. I love the way the Somme Museum is all about strong Ulster stock going out and defending the emperor. Don't mention those Catholic types. They didn't have anything to do with that. It really gets you an insight into an ideology. And this is something we had to cope with in Kilmaine, which was this. How do you communicate to a public an ideology so potent that men will systematically line themselves up over a period of months and starve themselves to death? Right? The 1981 hunger strikes. How do you get inside the power of that? And the only way you can do it is, unfortunately, in some views, is to empathise with it. You've got to explain it on its own terms, if not quite in its own terms. So you're always shimmering between putting some kind of a framework on it, but allowing people the access to the emotional power that leads people to understand the world in that way. So for instance, if you were running an Islamic museum in England today, would you have your apologetics up front, saying, now you really need to understand these, there's a great sweeping world history, or would you say, here's what it's like to be a young Islam today and what anger feels like from the inside? Would you go at it in that way? And which produces the better form of understanding? And there's always this threat to what we do as government officials running these technologies of governmental propaganda, essentially, in the end of the day, that we end up in this middle space where we're trying to please everybody because our masters want us to do that anyway. And we end up with the celebratory rising note, of course, always. Whereas, in fact, an awful lot of what we should be talking about is not really worth celebrating, and we shouldn't, in all decency, be trying to get the celebratory note at all.
That's a very interesting point. Thank you.
I just want to say that the other difficulty is that we are talking about a national museum, but in lots of ways, when you're within Australia, the differences between states are quite substantial, and the stories and the representation are different from different states. Outside Australia, we might see ourselves as Australians, but sometimes we don't see ourselves that way when we're within the country.
There was one question that I wanted to ask as well. If an Australian or the Vietnamese grandmother that Richard invokes went into that exhibition knowing nothing about Ireland or Irish Australia, was there one image that they would come away with at the end of how Australia would have been different if the Irish hadn't come?
It's the master's question, isn't it?
Well, not necessarily, I think. Anyway, I'll just put that out there. Yes.
Well, of course, I'm a fifth-generation Australian who didn't know she had any Irish in her until relatively recently, so I can only speak of my impressions walking through there. I, of course, know the Australian story, and I was continually amazed as I came across every story that I thought was familiar to me that there was an Irish element of it. And, for example, Surgeon John White, I had no idea. He was Irish and he's there right at the front. And in answer to Pat Cook's comment, I think the Irish have good reason to celebrate being in Australia. I think it is a celebratory story, particularly when I look at the Irish of my youth and how they were definitely the minority in Australian society, and they're certainly not now, and I think that is worth celebrating, despite all of the dark sides which inevitably are there.
My only point there is that if you set out with a celebratory agenda, you will assuredly end up with celebration.
Yes.
And some of the darker notes get lost then.
We're pretty much running out of time if we don't want to incur the wrath of the security men. So I think at this point I'm going to invite Richard to respond and wrap up. And thank you all for your participation.
Yes, where do you start? You know, you can give him his money, by the way. I think he's deserved it after all that. Thanks, you, Pat. Yeah. Look, I mean, we could sit here for another 2 hours throwing these points around. I did stand up on the Aboriginal one. That was because of, you know, where this museum stands on that question. And this museum stands very firmly in that question, that a third of this museum is about the Aboriginal issue within Australia. You very well know that when all that started, there was a huge outcry about how it had been tackled. You know, massacres, people jumping off cliffs. My God, that can't be the case. You know, we had the black armband view of history. When I set out to do this exhibition, though, and it's a bit ironic that Vowell says to me, you know, where are the seamstresses, where are the gangers, where are these people? My own thesis is actually about them, you know, Irish assisted immigrants, who are exactly those sort of people. But what you're driven to in an exhibition like this is exactly the point that Pat's making about being a national institution. If you're a national institution in the national capital, where that place on the hill is looking over your shoulder the whole time, you know, you have got to be aware of it. Now, I could have gone out and been hugely controversial and said, what this story of the Irish in this country about is about rebels, it's about the working class, it's about that struggle up from the bottom and everything else. And I can tell you, I would have been in great trouble, right, to do that. That's just political. That's just reality of where you sit working for a public service institution. I am a public servant, a federal public servant. So therefore, I've got to think of all those things out there where people might interact with an exhibition like that, where they want to come in. For example, they want to come in from Western Australia, you know, that they're just here for a day and say, well, where are we in this thing? You know, have you got something in here about us? Or people from Tasmania? And that's important in a national institution. So you're driven to start in the whole exhibition by making sure you cover certain kinds of things. For example, I know for a fact that the Protestant element, if you like, in the Australian churches is really underdone. It was important. You know, it was there. I went searching for it in Melbourne. I went trying to find objects that I thought would attract people. That's the other thing, by the way, that's very important in an exhibition. The objects that you bring into it have got to be inherently interesting and attractive in themselves. You've got to do that. I mean, you know, we're not paid here to put on books on walls about all the issues that might go around the Irish. You know, and I know there's all sorts of issues there that don't get into the exhibition in the way perhaps that if you were writing a book on the subject, you would like to see them there. I fully accept that. Therefore, I understand what Val says, and I know where the gaps are in the exhibition. At the same time, our public has told us, as has come through it, that they have been simply thrilled to see all these things, you know, and that's what the museum is here to do, to put on a show, a display. Now, of course, you can start into the epistemological underpinnings of where we're coming from and all that, but the basic point we're coming from is, can we put on a successful exhibition that people will come through the door, look at it, and enjoy it in one way or the other, without also doing great harm, you know, to the overall story. Now, I would say, and we can talk about this more this evening, anybody likes to talk to me about it, I don't think we have done great violence to the story. You know, I really don't. I believe that. If I didn't believe that, I wouldn't have gone through with the exercise. Are there failures in it? Absolutely. If I had another year to do it, would I have found other things? Undoubtedly. We had 1 year with a certain amount of money, and that's it. It's like your thesis, you know. You research it for a bit and your supervisor then says, right, you sit down now and you write it. You're not going to be able to go and, you know, endlessly research until you find all those things that you think ought to be in it. That's reality. It's the reality of the institution. It's the reality of all of us in life. You've got to come to a halt and say, what have I found? Now, I went out and I found some things that I knew were there and others that I didn't know were there. And I would contest, by the way, about the Durex. The Durex were poor assisted immigrants, right? Very poor. From Clare. Ryan's people were very poor, you know, all of them. And I didn't put Ryan up as a kind of successful pastor. I put him up as a convict with his ticket of leave and certificate of freedom. Yeah, the orphan girl box was there. There are indications in there. The most poignant story, if I could finish on this, in the whole exhibition, well, there are two, I think, two really poignant stories. One I talked to you about, the Sisters of St. John of God and Gabby Dolby up there in the Northwest. The other one is in John Moriarty, Aboriginal activist, right, in the 1960s, and then going back to Ireland, I mean, in the 1980s, to find his Irish father, right, a man coming out of, you know, Saltwater Fella is his book, coming out of the Northern Territory. I mean, he lived all that stuff. He lived that idea of what had happened to his mother's people, right, through the whole history that he went through. But what did he want to try and go back and find? What's the Irish bit of me? And he went back and he found this 90-year-old guy called Aeroplane O'Shea in Kerry. You know, and he went up to the door in Kerry, knocked on the door. He was told this guy had something to tell him. He could tell him about who he was. And this very elderly man, John, tells this story, peeped out, and he said, "I'm a Moriarty." And he looked at him. John looks a bit, he looks a bit European, but black skin. Oh, yes. You know? And it took him 20 minutes to get through the door, right, to convince O'Shea that who he was, who he said he was. Then he comes in, and O'Shea says, "I have something here from your father. Your father came and fished here before he went to Australia in 1928, and goes to the cupboard and pulls out this fishing rod that his father had used. And John takes it back here and treasures it beyond anything else, right? And that's his relationship. Even that was in the Kerry Press. So there's a relationship, if you like. Yes, we've come here, we've plundered the land, we've taken it from the Aboriginal people, we've done all those things. But here's John Moriarty going in the opposite direction and saying, "I'm actually finding something out of all that that is quite positive for me as an Aboriginal activist and an Aboriginal person." And those messages are in there, in the exhibition. They're complex, they're difficult, but they're there. But you've got to go and look for them and find them. But I do accept the comments. I thank you for the comments. They enliven me for the next round of the Irish in Australia, where there will be a next round. And thank you very much for the comments from the floor. And we now need to really move to get up. Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.